Welcome to the daily VFN Radio Highlights, where we're keeping the conversation light at VFNTV.com. Enjoy.
People in America reportedly died of a mysterious plague. The reports say, as mysteriously as it blew in, it blew out. In 1918 and 1919, 65% of the world's population, you know, and we're going to talk about this Ebola and what's taking place. We're going to look back at the history of America, and we're also going to see how we're reacting similarly. Right now we have a virus sweeping across the almost every state. And children are getting paralyzed. They can't breathe. Mm-hmm. Some have died. At the same time, we have Ebola, and we're seeing what's taking place. We look back at John Paul Jackson, some of the prophetic words that were spoken of about the coming storm, and we have had that. We've talked about that. And it's happening. These things are happening in addition to a lot of other things taking place. But today we're going to talk about, you know, plagues and what is a plague. It's not something that happened back in the 18th century or the 16th century. This is something that's happened continually throughout mankind. And when you're looking, you know, here we are, you're not getting any full questions. When you listen to some of the leadership today, when they talk about Ebola, which is a organ-eating, devouring, we'll hear more about that according to the doctors, virus that you have days, it's 90% death rate.
Yeah.
90% death rate. And that was nowhere near influenza. Influenza, when it came, out of, I think it was 500 million were infected, but 50 million died.
Wow. 50 million.
And, you know, that's not 90% death rate. Mm-mm. And so we need to pay attention not because of fear or anything like that. We need to pay attention. You know, God, you know, what does this mean? You know, what's taking place? And when you read your Bible, you have to understand he talks about plagues. He talks about plagues. And the plague that took place in 1918 happened, that means 1,918 years after Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. In other words, this is in the new covenant. You know, by the way, in us, and Sapphira in the new covenant too, and all that. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that's unrealistic. When people say these things don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll find out some of the arrogance of Americans in 1918, 1919. They really believed that they were so righteous, according to reports, and that there's no way that it would actually happen to them. And if it did happen, it would happen to the people on the other side of the tracks. It wouldn't happen. I mean, the arrogance of that. As we were fighting the Woodrow War, mm-hmm. you know, World War I, that we see ourselves in history as some heroes who were doing that, but aren't we killing the image and the likeness of God and these different mm-hmm. things taking place at that time? You know, World War II is a totally different war than World War I. And so all of a sudden we got on the world field and began to do this. Why we were in that war, think about it, the first world war, why we entered into it, that's when a plague swept across the world. And it happened because people began to travel globally, called soldiers. Mm. Called soldiers. And back at that time, there was just really soldiers doing that kind of international travel. I mean, you had to get on a ship. You had to go somewhere. But today, you know, reports are 700-something million people traveled globally in 2012. 700-something million.
Yeah.
More people than died in the influenza. But first, I want us to go right to an interview with Franklin Graham and Glenn Beck and the doctor for Samaritan Purse. Because remember, it was the doctor,
Kent Brantley,
who was with Samaritan's Purse, that was there, who just got there like within a year or something, mm-hmm. to help them out with this, that got infected. So he's going to begin to describe what it's really like. I mean, who better than Samaritan Purse, who's right there and has been there? But just watch this.
Pilar, the doctor is an emergency technical advisor at Samaritan's Purse. He was part of the disaster. He led the disaster response team in Liberia. Doctor, how are you?
Hey, go ahead. Good to see you. Franklin, good to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
We were having dinner last week with the Green family, the greatest people. I love these people, the Hobby Lobby people, and they have just started a Museum of the Bible.
Yes.
And so we're sitting there. It's you, me, my wife, the Greens, Bobby Jindal, and we start talking about Ebola.
Right.
And it dawns on me, oh, crap, that was your doctor. And you started telling me stories that, honestly, I didn't think that you would be willing to come on the air and tell. Start from the beginning on, well, first, actually, doctor, let me start with you.
Yes.
What is it like? You guys are going over to serve the poor, heal the sick, do God's work. What is it like over there?
Yeah. Well, Glenn, I left Liberia in mid-August. It's really, since then, it's reached unprecedented proportions. It's really gone into the exponential phase. But I can tell you, I was there about 2 months this summer. It's worse than the statistics indicate. It is, as the Doctors Without Borders said in April, out of control. It very much is out of control. It's a monumental epidemic. There's thousands.
Explain what it is like working in one of those rooms. It must be, I mean, it's got to be hell on earth.
It really is. It's as you've read, there's a big disproportion between the caregivers and the number of patients to start off with. And then it's extremely hot, as you can imagine, and humid in West Africa. And then to top that off, you have to don this full PPE, personal protective equipment, and you enter into this room. There's a suspected side of the Ebola treatment unit. These patients are awaiting PCR or testing to confirm whether or not they have Ebola, and then there's a confirmed side.
Is that pretty much a death sentence?
It's not exclusively a death sentence, but it's pretty close. The mortality rate with Ebola Zaire is up to 90%.
Fear in people, I mean, it's a good thing that, you know, we have religious people going over to help, because the fear in people's eyes must be intense.
It is. They are. They recognize how serious.
Tell me about the fear in the caregivers.
You know, everybody has made a very educated decision, of course, to participate. But there, nonetheless, that doesn't completely mitigate the fear. There is certainly a real fear in treating. But it is very protocol driven. We were, very. Motivated, of course, to follow protocol, to wear the full PPE to protect ourselves. But there is something unusual about this epidemic relative to just it just seems to be there's something unknown still about this Ebola. It's just infected
this
so many people.
This particular strand
outbreak.
Of it?
Yes, yes, sir.
Okay, so let me start here, because the first question I think I asked you was, you guys are taking all kinds of precautions. You just said it.
Yes.
What I haven't understood was, how did the doctor get it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did he get it?
He doesn't know. I asked him specifically, Glenn. He thinks it wasn't where we were treating Ebola. It was in the hospital with a very sick patient that had come in. He had seen that patient, and that was an evening, and he feels that is probably where he got infected.
So malaria is huge over there, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, so
everybody
has a fever. So yeah. If I come in and I have a fever, but I don't know I have Ebola, but I have malaria or whatever, mm-hmm. and I'm sweaty, mm-hmm. and if I just come up to you and you're not donned with everything, and I just go, doctor, do I have it now? Good chance I have it?
Well, they do say, Glenn, that it's not transmitted via casual contact, but I would not touch his hand because, as I said, something's different. So it is transmitted by body fluids. Even sweat can transmit the
so
virus.
So how does the doctor think he got it? Did somebody bleed on him in that other? No, you don't know.
You don't know.
Well, that's concerning.
Yeah. And we did, and we recognize that perhaps even the hospitals over there are more dangerous than the Ebola treatment units, because in the ETUs or Ebola treatment units, we will wear full PPE. In the hospitals, it's really challenging. We establish triage, but as you've already alluded to, there's so many diseases there that are endemic in Africa that mimic Ebola in the early stage.
And so here's the really scary part. You are running Samaritan's Purse. You're a good Samaritan. The people who are going over there are driven by something else. They're driven by God. And they all got on a plane knowing what they're going
to
do.
Well, first of all, Glenn, we were not in Liberia to treat Ebola. We've been in Liberia for the last 10 years, ever since the end of the Civil War, taking care of orphans, dealing with women who have been raped during the war, and helping people get back on their feet. We reopened airfields in the country because the roads were impassable, helped to get a Bible school up and running, agricultural projects. These are things that
so
we were doing.
How did you get into the Ebola war?
In March when Ebola came into Sierra Leone and Guinea, it came up on the Liberian border. And we began to use our, we have a helicopter in the country. We also have a fixed-wing airplane. We began to use our aircraft to fly WHO, World Health Organization people, medicines, or Doctors Without Borders. We were carrying their people, carrying blood samples back and forth to Monrovia. And then when it came into Liberia, there was no one there to fight Ebola. And we decided that we would take this on.
Jeez.
So we stopped all of our projects, all of them. We have close to 500 people that work for Samaritan's Purse in Liberia. These would be Liberian staff. We stopped all of that, and we put all of our attention on Ebola. And we worked very closely with Doctors Without Borders. We took all the precautions and that they recommended, all of the procedures we put in place. So we are confident that we were running as safe as operation as anybody could do. Remember, there were only two groups handling Ebola at that point. That was Doctors Without Borders and Samaritan's Purse. No other groups in the world were dealing with Ebola.
Okay. So this brings me back. Yes. Right now, we have people. The CDC doesn't want to go clean up the vomit in this guy's house in Dallas. When this thing, if God forbid, becomes a pandemic, you don't have enough doctors, you don't have enough nurses, you don't have the people who are willing or the resources willing to really take this on. You can't get them in Dallas to clean it up.
Well, and the problem, Glenn, is in Africa. There are not enough beds. Now, the president is sitting in a hospital, a military hospital. Mm-hmm. There will never be enough beds for the sick people. You're going to have to turn people away. And so we're looking at a community care centers that we're going to operate several of these. It will be the same thing as an Ebola treatment clinic, except we won't be using IVs. We'll use antibiotics and we'll be using oral rehydration for them to take. What we're going to start focusing on is home health care and really right. training Liberians on how to manage and care for their sick at home. Because there's just not enough beds, and so
my grandfather used to say, because he grew up, you know, right around the turn of the century, and he said, "You're not bringing me to a hospital." I'm like, "Grandpa, the hospital's where you go to die."
Correct.
And that kind of stuff is going to start coming again because it was all about disease.
But people would like to go to a hospital.
Sure,
but Glenn, there will never be enough beds.
Okay,
never.
So when we come back, I want to find out what happened when the doctor found out. Oh gosh, I have it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then this miracle treatment and how spooky it was and what you went through on that. And then the airplane and the travel back here to America.
So you're looking at, you know, that's firsthand. That's Samaritan Purse. All of our partners who are standing with us and our sponsors understand that that's why we drive you to VFNTV.com to partner with Samaritan Purse. As you'll see that we've been connected up for quite some time. We want you to connect up and just be there. But also, when we get back from this break, we want to be able to discover, you know, more details about this, what's happening now, and how people are lightly responding to it, and how similar it is in regards to what happened when America, 1% of America's population died in 1918, 1919, by something so mysterious. Because some of the key words they said was, "We don't know." There's something unusual about this, and there's some unknowns about this. And at this, I'm going to think about what we know now and since 1918. So we're going to go right into Danielle Colburn on YouTube. She gives a great report about this influenza that hit America, this mysterious influenza that took 1% of America's population. Watch this.
The influenza pandemic of 1918 supposedly struck first in Kansas among Army recruits at Camp Funston. The outbreak occurred in three waves. The first was hardly more than the common flu. The second wave, however, was deadly. The second wave began in Spain, which is why it is known as the Spanish flu. By May 1918, 8 million in Spain were dead. From Spain, the influenza swept back into the United States. And from the United States, the influenza traveled to Europe by way of American troops. The reason the influenza struck so hard is because of the Great War, or World War I. The war had mobilized armies from countries all over the world, and so the strain of the influenza was carried worldwide. The economic impacts of the influenza were short-term. Wages increased slightly for the workers, and the per capita growth of each state directly correlated to the mortality rate. But many businesses suffered. This influenza targeted healthy, working-age adults. Businesses were already short-handed due to the draft. Because of the influenza, they lost more workers, as well as consumers. Those killed by the normal influenza were generally the very young and the elderly, or those who were already sick. This influenza, however, was often called the Great Leveler of Men, as it killed the young, the old, and those between the ages of 15 to 44. It did not discriminate between the healthy and the weak. People could start feeling sick on their way home from work and be dead within hours. By the time the influenza passed, it had killed 0.66% of the U.S. population, and the life expectancy had declined 11.8 years. The first wave of the flu was highly ignored, partly due to the political turmoil. At the time the first wave hit, Woodrow Wilson had just announced his 14 points, which were highly controversial. The influenza of 1918 was one of the first times that the U.S. put a significant effort into public health. As a result of these public health attempts, many new laws were put into place. Some cities required mask wearing, especially by policemen. Cities also outlawed spitting in an attempt to slow the spread of disease, and they enforced this law very strongly. As a result of the panic, many fake doctors and treatments caught the eye of the public. Qualified doctors were sparse, since many were overseas. Hospitals soon filled up, and emergency hospitals had to be figured out. These were often filled with girls working as nurses with little experience. I liked the work just fine, but it was too hard, not being used to it. When I was in the officers' barracks, four of the officers of whom I had charge died. Two of them were married and called for their wife nearly all the time. It was sure pitiful to see them die. I was right in the wards alone with them each time, and oh, the first one that died sure unnerved me. I had to go to the nurses' quarters and cry it out. The other three were not so bad. To stop transmission of the flu, health departments shut down public meeting places, such as theaters, beaches, and other places the disease might spread. Many public transportation areas were either shut down or would not allow people to ride without a mask. People were reliant on the newspaper, since there was not broad access to radio, and mail was often slow in coming when postmen got sick.
Its name was Enza. I opened up the window and influenza.
The 1918 influenza killed more people in the United States than four wars combined. In World War I, 116,708 were killed. In World War II, 408,306 were killed. In the Vietnam War, 58,219 were killed. In the Korean War, 54,246 were killed. The combined deaths of Americans in combat from these four wars was 637,479. The 1918 influenza killed approximately 675,000 people in the United States. Telegraph services collapsed when their operators got the virus. Garbage men called in sick and garbage piled up. So many children were orphaned that in some cities, the orphanages did not have enough room for all of them. Some bodies were left unclaimed in the morgues, and some cities would not allow funerals or limited them to 15 minutes. schools and businesses were closed. Many cases were unaccounted for as public health officials got sick and the pandemic was too hard to track with the new cases that came in every day. Doctors tried to produce a vaccine but could not do so in time. Though there had been advances in microbiology, scientists did not have the knowledge necessary to fight a virus. People of this time relied on whatever means of medicine they believed in the most, though none were really effective. The Spanish flu eventually faded on its own after claiming between 20 and 40 million lives worldwide. The world has not seen a pandemic with such devastating effects since the influenza of 1918.
This is so important because we learn from what happened. Here we are. You think about the 14 points. This is what the 14 points with the president was at the time. That World War I, we need to get into the war because it's a moral cause. That's what Paul said. It's a moral, in other words, this is a, wow. of God. This is a God war when you say it's a moral cause getting into a war. This nation whose original intent was supposed to be, you know, one nation under God, you know, indivisible and all those things we talk about. And these 14 points, and there's so many similarities. And I want you to see this this sword piece here and see how similar it is. And you think about that people are just making light of it. Remember, there's a first wave nobody paid a big attention to. The second wave came in and swept out over half, 500 million people got infected. Let's watch this one segment here.
What was called the Spanish influenza, which is a completely bad rap, by the way, on Spain. It's called the Spanish influenza because Spain, not being a belligerent in the war, what happened in Spain got into everybody's newspapers fast. What happened in Germany, France, the United States, Great Britain was subjected to censorship. So in the world press, the only nation whose plight vis-a-vis flu was widely publicized with Spain. So everybody said it's the Spanish flu. It shouldn't have been called the Spanish flu any more than it should have been called the Japanese flu. Well, many of them did not identify it as influenza because it didn't fit the definition. Influenza does not kill people in great numbers. Influenza does not particularly affect young adults. Influenza is a pest. It's not a slaughter of human beings. So they fumbled around in their diagnoses, as Welch suggested plague. Other people suggested meningitis. Some of them decided to, some of them became exceptionally, went over the top in patriotism and decided to blame it on the Germans and some sort of poison gas, which U-boats had released on the beaches of the United States. They came up with 100 different diagnoses and so often avoided the obvious one, because which was influenza, because influenza does not kill people in large numbers. So this couldn't be influenza. The first reaction of the authorities was... For many of the most important ones was just flat-out denial. This was simply too large an event for them to deal with, not only in policy, but even think about constructively. So the chief health officer of New York, a man named Royal Copeland, denied it when it became undeniable, said it wasn't any great danger. He talked a good game throughout the entire epidemic, and there were other people like him right across the United States. It's easy to blame these people in retrospect, but of course we have the advantage of hindsight. Not only was this simply too big for them to take in as fast as they needed to take it in. If it had been a slow-moving epidemic, maybe they would have had a month, 2 months to realize, yeah, it really is happening out there. Instead, down the telegraph wires would come these almost unbelievable stories. If they were believable, you were supposed to do something. If they were unbelievable, you didn't have to do anything. And so a lot of health officers and a lot of politicians to whom the health officers would have, you know, people they'd have to convince, preferred not to face it. There's an old American tradition that we are the most moral people in the face of the earth, and therefore these visitations from an angry God don't hit us. They hit somebody else. And most epidemic diseases hit the poor harder than they do the rich, and of course the rich, the elites. And so a lot of the elites wouldn't face up to this, or took the way out of the excuse of not facing up to this by saying it won't hit us on the hill, it'll hit those people down there, the immigrants in the lowlands. And this had been true, was true about tuberculosis and a number of the most prevalent diseases of the time. But influenza is very, very democratic. There were two enormously important things going on at once, and they were at right angles to each other. One, of course, was the influenza epidemic, which dictated that you should sort of shut everything down, and the war, which demanded that everything should speed up, that certainly the factories should continue operating, you should continue to have bond drives, soldiers should be drafted, sent to the camps, jammed into barracks, put on boats, and with bunks six high, and sent off to France. One of the great tragedies of the situation is that there was no correct thing to do. You can't look back and say, if our officials had only done the correct thing. There wasn't any correct thing to do. We know now how flu spreads. It spreads by breath. It spreads through the air, which is why it moves so fast. To get typhoid, you have to drink infected water. But with influenza, all you have to breathe in is to breathe in while somebody else is breathing out. If you're on a subway car in an elevator with somebody with influenza who sneezes, that air will be utterly full of viruses, and you will breathe them in unless you can manage to hold your breath for X number of minutes. I don't think there's any disease that moves any faster than through a population than influenza, because it is perfectly adapted to be breath-borne. It's a disease of the lungs, and every time you breathe out all kinds of virus, and in this case, you're exhaling flu virus.
So why things could be way worse today than it was in 1918 and a prophetic dream the Lord gave me about massive death. We want to be able to bring this home and understand, you know, what's going on and how we respond to a biblical response. Not enough to know the news, you need to know what to do with the news you know. And we, you know, whatever God says, he's right, and we just need to respond to it. Secondly is he tells us things so that we can know in advance, so we can ask him, Lord, would you not do this thing? And we repent, and he stops these things that are coming our way. I had a dream. The Lord gave me a dream. In this prophetic dream, I saw a massive amount of people in America who did not survive. And now when I see these stats from, you know, the influenza with 65% of the world's population, this is something that's happened before. There were so many deaths that took place in this dream, and you think about Rick Joyner and what he talked about was taking place, mm-hmm. but I was thinking more of that way. But with a plague, with this enterovirus D68 that's hitting the children, remember it hits the children and the young people, the influenza did, but now we have something hitting the children. But a commercial airline in this prophetic dream was closed down, just dedicated to removing corpses. I mean, think about that. And so we need to pay attention. What do we need to do? And why things could be much worse today compared to 1918? I mean, you think about it, at that time, the only ones that traveled internationally mostly were the soldiers who were going to fight the World War I. So we decided this 14-point moral cause war that Woodrow Wilson wanted to be able to fight, which, by the way, we also talked about in earlier programs, how Woodrow Wilson and Barack Obama are similar in how they were selected before they were elected for the purpose of an agenda called a progressive agenda. We have all that for you as well. And it's like, man, this thing is identical to what's taking place. But this, think about this. So that's the only ones that were traveling international. So it began with the soldiers. Today, according to the UN World Tourism Organization, in 2012, 705 million traveled from country to country. Hmm. 705 million. That's more than who died,
right?
You know, of the or got affected by the virus. And today's population now, compared to the population, that is like three times as it is. Then, for example, in 1918, the population in America was 103 million. 208,000, according to the census. You know, so 675,000 people died, or 10% of the population. Okay. What's today's population? Today's population is 316 million. And it mysteriously came in and it mysteriously left. And the thing about it, remember the arrogance. That's why we wanted you to see that, you know, and you get the whole access to all the full parts of these stories at VFNTV.com on the torch. But understand what they were saying was they were going like, we are moral people. We're the most moral nation in the world. This won't happen to us. And if it does happen to us, it's going to happen to, you know, Liberia, West Africa. We need to block all them folks off and keep them coming from Liberia, from West Africa. Or it's going to happen to somebody who's not as privileged as we are. I mean, the arrogance. And this is what they said I thought was pretty powerful, that the influenza virus was very democratic. It went through, I mean, think about it. 50 million people died in the world. And all these stats are going to be available for you so you can see, you know, how, which country and how many died in each country. But think about that. More, there were so many children orphaned during that time that there wasn't enough orphanages for them. There wasn't enough caskets for the bodies. You had to remove the body rapidly because you would get, just like they're talking about Ebola today, that you will get contaminated by that body if you touch it. You cannot come near it. How they're reporting that those that are working with some of the Ebola patients, their families won't even let them back in their house again because they're worried about touching them. So what's going on? I mean, what's happening and how should we respond? All I know is what God says in his word. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 13 through 14, this is what the word of God says. When I, God, when I send a plague amongst my people, that's what he says. When I send a plague amongst my people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I'll hear from heaven, I will forgive their sin, and I will heal their land. I mean, think about the choir of tragedies that are taking place right now. And now on top of it, we have, think about it, you would get a cold in the morning and you would die before you got home that night with influenza. They're saying with influenza, just so you know it, you had a 10% chance of death. With Ebola, you have up to 90% chance of death. Think about it. It's nine times worse, and we're just going, it's not going to touch us. We're acting just like Americans acted then versus going, as Christians, we need to have compassion. We need to repent. We need to say, dear God, forgive me. I've sinned against you. I sinned against my fellow man. Dear Lord, forgive my sins. Heal our land. Restore our nation back to its original tent. And forgive us for dividing the land of Israel and not standing for them. Help us to stand up for Israel and the gospel. We just ask this in Jesus' name. You've just been listening to the highlights from VFN-TV and the Data Radio program, where we're keeping the conversation light. Listen or watch more programs and check out the VFN Torch at VFNTV.com. Don't forget about our VFN-TV app, where no matter where you are, you can take the light with you and share with your friends. We want to thank our sponsors and partners who make this program possible. Take the time and support our sponsors. You can locate them at VFNTV.com and select sponsors. If you'd like to become a sponsor or a partner, you can do so at VFNTV.com. VFNTV and the Daily Radio Program, where we're keeping the conversation light.